Rapid expansion?
We're ready.
Worker shortage?
We're good.
Anything can change the world of work.
A celebrity buys the company.
Depends on who it is. But relax, we've got ADP.
From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
Hi, this is Jason Gay from the Wall Street Journal coming at you from an undisclosed location. Coming up now, part three of our conversation with basketball writer extraordinaire Chris Herring of the Wall Street Journal.
You're listening to Free For All from the Wall Street Journal. Now, here's Jason Gay.
We're back here on the Free For All with Chris Herring, basketball writer extraordinaire, Knicks chronicler for the Wall Street Journal. Chris, I have this theory about New York sports that people laugh because they don't remember the last time when the Knicks were really, really the toast of the town. But this city is a Knicks city fundamentally. Like, listen, we have two football teams. We have two baseball teams. The Mets were in the World Series last year. It was a big deal. Giants won a Super Bowl a couple years ago. It was a really big deal. But there is nothing, and I know we got Brooklyn Nets, whatever. There's nothing that makes New York crazier than a hot Knicks team. And we've actually seen little degrees of it in the last few years. Of course, we had that 54-win season. We had Linsanity, a couple weeks of that. Even flickers of it the beginning of this year with Porzingis out of the box being a high-performing rookie. Do you think that's true? I mean, because you are – one of the things that I admire about the way that you've covered the sport is that I feel like you have reached out to that fan base, and you are very much in contact with your hardcore Knicks audience. Do you think there's real truth to that, that once the Knicks get it together finally, if they ever do, New York is just going to rock like it doesn't for any other team?
I think it's an unbelievable fan base, and the thing is – it's weird to me. Sometimes it's hard to convey that because the best way to measure that normally is attendance, you know, And the Knicks sell out regardless of whether they're winning or losing. Right. So that aspect of it is hard to explain to people from the outside, but just the passion from the fan base.
I think of it as truck drivers leaning out of trucks and screaming at people on the street, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I
had people yell at me left and right on Twitter, the last time they were really good, that 54-win season in 12-13, I picked the Pacers to beat them in the second round and was called names and just like, what are you basing this on? Like, I thought you were smart, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, but just how passionate people were. And even in that moment, people calling for a coach's firing during that series, the best season the Knicks have had in 15 years, and people calling for a coach's firing in the middle of a series because they realize that their chances of winning that series are slipping away. The best season they've had in God knows how long. But that's how passionate this fan base is. It's like they get so worked up thinking that they have a chance. I mean, it is weird that the biggest market in the country and that it's so rare that they actually have a good team.
Every sport has been forced to become more social media savvy, and every sport likes to claim that they're social media savvy. But I think basketball has the best grip on sort of the metabolism of what social media is like right now. And the NBA has, I think, rather brilliantly been kind of hands off in terms of, you know, protecting copyrights and things like that when people want to Vine highlights of games and stuff like that. They haven't threatened to shut down people here and there. I mean, they probably have on occasion, but you know, they've more or less taken a hands-off policy towards the way people are talking and sharing the game. And basketball Twitter, which we both are part of, or I'm more of as an observer and you're a beloved member of, you know, it's a really fun subset of the social media experience. It's really funny. There are some people out there that I don't even know if they have like some sort of periodical attachment who are just brilliant and funny. And there's a life to the game now that exists online. And I'm curious, you know, because you have a commitment, of course, to, you know, a news organization, which you have to cover the game. But like that also is part of your life now, right?
Yeah. It's rare, unless maybe if I'm in a game with a friend. You know, I took a buddy to a game recently, but unless I'm doing that, it's I don't like to watch the games without also following along on Twitter to see what funny joke is going to be made. Sometimes, you know, it's rare now with TV and all the capability they have of showing things over again. But, you know, if there's not a replay shown of something, you know, you can make sure, like Carmelo trying to dunk the other night and getting
that.
Stuffed
right.
by the rim. You know it's going to be up on Twitter and on Vine two
Absolutely.
Seconds later, whereas,
Absolutely.
You know, the Knicks may not want to show that. Thinking about an awkward moment, Jim Dolan, Rasheed Wallace, like, kind of hugging Jim Dolan really awkwardly because they don't like to show Dolan. Dolan isn't shown on MSG.
Well, what they show a lot of, you know, and social media has been brilliant about picking up are real, like, defensive lapses or, like, dirty play away from the basket, things that the cameras, you know, are picking up sort of in the periphery but don't get noticed by the announcers because they're following the ball.
Right. They're following the ball, and a lot of times the networks aren't interested in embarrassing
right.
their
They're
own
partners.
Players.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
so I mean, people are better at picking that up than the networks are a lot of the time. So it's valuable to some extent. And honestly, you know, I've talked to my editors here, including those sorts of things in the stories, embedding those sorts of
yeah.
lines in the stories, because they kind of illustrate what I'm getting at in my pieces better than my words can sometimes.
No, there's no substitute for talking about somebody like, let's take, you know, everyone picks on him, but poor Dion Waiters in OKC, you know, who thinks he's, you know, the next Jordan, if only if he just gets, you know, 30 shots a game. You know, his sort of desperate pleas for the ball when Westbrook and Durant, I mean, nothing, you can write about that 1,000 times, but you look at the vines of it, and it's just the funniest thing you've ever seen in your entire life.
Yeah, I kind of feel bad for him just because, I mean, he's had, even lately, he's had like a couple games where he started 0 for 6, 0 for 7 coming out of the All-Star break, but it just kind of reminds you of the guy that you play with at the Y that
yeah.
doesn't understand that he's not that good. And doesn't understand why you're not passing him the ball. And it's like you're catching this guy in real time on Vine and on Twitter all the time.
Do you buy the idea that basketball fans, you know, every generation of basketball fan or fan in any sport likes to think they are the smartest, savviest subset of fans? But, you know, I just think that because of the availability of the product and because people have things like NBA TV and so on, they're watching it on their phones, they can watch highlights later, they have Vines, they have Twitter, etc., there's a sophistication of your average fan online that is unmatched, I think. And also, you don't have to be regional anymore. You know, you can be a super fan of the Miami Heat and live in Vancouver. You can be a massive, massive Timberwolves fan in China. The geography boundaries that once existed are gone, and you have this whole world of fans who know so much about so many teams.
I have had fans. It's weird. I've gotten more emails from fans this year than I ever have before. You know, and to a point now where I probably get 3-4 of them a week. So I'm asking for advice from students and stuff. But a lot of them are just fans, like, thanking me for writing about one of their favorite teams. I got one from Korea the other day saying that they really just started to kind of sink in the NBA and watching it more. And it's just kind of amazing to see the reach that the game has. But also, you know, I love it, too, how informed a lot of the fans are, because it kind of keeps me on my toes. I've written really, really in-depth pieces about things and then had people email me and say, well, did you think about this?
Yeah.
Because, you know, you use this number and I understand how you reached that conclusion, but, you know, did you control for this aspect of it? And it's like, I have people, you know, I feel like I'm like a scientist or something, and I'm like finding a cure for something, or at least like something that explains some theory that I have, and then someone else, like, kind of with their own, you know, hypothesis on the same thing. It's fascinating because people are really thinking about the game.
Now, you're not a purely analytics guy, though that's a big part of what you do.
Sure.
We've seen in the last bunch of years several examples of people who began in journalism crossing over to the dark side, not the dark side, but the
John Hollinger.
John Hollinger went to the Grizzlies, mm-hmm. and then Kirk Goldsberry,
Spurs,
from Grantland, who does those amazing shot charts, is now working with the Spurs.
Right.
Would you ever consider that? If the Bulls, your hometown Bulls, came calling and said, Chris, we need someone to break down.
I've had people here and there kind of just make passing, you know, like, is this something you would even consider?
So it's been broached. Wow.
Every now and then.
Yeah.
I don't think so. Maybe I'm just really into my own voice. I don't think it's a voice thing, but there's something I love about seeing my name in the newspaper.
Yeah.
I tweeted a picture the other day of being in the airport and seeing this guy reading my story.
Oh, it's the best.
And how cool that is. They're like,
yeah.
Well, did you go up and say anything to him? No, I don't want to be a creepy person, but there's something about that. I remember the first time seeing that happen when I was in high school writing for my high school paper.
Yeah.
Not that I need the attention of seeing my name or anything like that, but you don't get to interact with fans the same way. And that's become one of the favorite parts of my job. I mean, it's not necessarily my job to interact with fans.
Yeah.
But I love doing that, and I don't think I could do it in a way, in as personable a way, if I was working for a team and all of a sudden I become the great and powerful Oz who's behind a curtain.
Yeah.
You know, I'd rather interact with people, and I'd rather, you know, have people be able to share their ideas with me in a way where it's not totally proprietary and, you know, people don't get to actually see what I'm working on.
We hear so much about the volatility in media and the way that sports jobs have changed radically. And, you know, I write a sports column. I think that the heyday of the sports column is probably not 2016, and that someone who did this job in 1965 or 1945 or 1971 probably was used to a different level of attention and clout. I'm not complaining. But I look at basketball and I think, you know, these might be the glory days. This might be the high point of basketball media when I look out and see how, you know, dynamic and interesting the coverage is and how many people are kind of developing not just massive social media followings, but sort of new ways of looking at the game. You know, I can point to a half dozen people right off the top of my head who are doing really interesting things in basketball. And you know all these people out there. And is it fun to be part of that?
Oh, it's really fun. I mean, it's challenging. It's kind of like what you asked a little bit earlier about, you know, how it feels to be kind of part of this analytics movement. But at the same time, knowing that at some point what's new will become old.
Yeah.
And so trying to stay on the cutting edge of that or trying to keep your content interesting, but also realizing that some of what you write will have an impact on things.
Yeah.
You know, several times I feel like I've written something and then I've heard back from someone within the Knicks or, you know, Steve Mills, the GM of the team, will be like, you know, that was fascinating. And it's something
yeah.
we're kind of looking at that you may not have known we're looking at.
Yeah.
And just in general, you know, watching some of the guys over at ESPN, they've been really driving the stake into this argument about, getting more rest for players and just how terrible the product becomes when you've got two teams that are playing each other on the back end of a back-to-back
yes,
or
yes.
three games in four nights and looking at the injury rates and tying some of that stuff into all this. And so, you know, the league has already adjusted the way that All-Star Weekend works and made it a whole week.
Yeah.
Which, you know, and then ESPN hammered back and said, that makes it worse because now you're giving them a week off, but now you're condensing the rest of the schedule into what would have been, you know, more open time. So
right.
the league is kind of even adjusting the way that they operate. I think that they don't want to give up games. They don't want to have it be a 75-game season
yeah.
instead of 82. But I think eventually they're going to have to find a way to lengthen things out.
Yeah, let's just do it, like, to wrap up, do like a sort of a quick round of questions on, I mean, do you think that we're going to see a shortened season at some point down the road? Or do you think it's going to be an expansion of the calendar?
I think what we're more likely to see, either the latter part, maybe an expansion of the calendar, or more likely what you'll see is that they'll shorten the games from 48 minutes to maybe 44 or 40.
And they've done that in preseason, I believe.
Right, they've tested it out.
Was it noticeable? I mean,
no.
Yeah.
I mean, not really. I mean,
yeah.
it would make it a little bit less onerous to watch.
But you need to, they'll be taking timeouts away and things like that.
I would hope, but I think that's more likely because you don't risk losing revenue by cutting the games shorter as opposed
yeah.
to just cutting games entirely.
Yeah.
NBA would very much like to raise the age minimum to 20, keeping most players in college for 2 years. You know, to be honest, I'm opposed to the idea of putting any sort of rule upon someone to
Me
make
too.
A living. I just, you know, Justin Me Bieber too. Wants to be a pop star at 11 years old. Knock yourself out, kid. You don't have to go to college. But do you think there's any chance that that's going to happen?
I think it's unlikely. I think they'd get a lot of pushback about it. I mean, you could make the argument that the high school part of it has been good, that they, you know, that they're making guys stay for 1 year.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it did have a really weird kind of phenomenon at the college level. For a while, Kentucky seemed really, really dominant with that. And now maybe it's starting to level out a little bit. But I don't think you need to do it to where it's 2 years. I think most guys that have 1 year, you have enough tape on them to know that they're good or whether they're good enough to at least make it in the league and belong there for that first year.
Yeah.
You have to let people make their own mistakes. If it's a mistake that they're there, then, you know, scouts need to get better at their jobs, but I wouldn't make it 2 years. I don't see the point in that, and I think it's unfair.
I was fascinated by something that Adam Silver told me when I spoke to him earlier this season, which was I was asking him about the idea of expansion, in particular expansion in Europe, and he said, you know, the thing about expansion you have to keep in mind is that there just aren't that many great basketball players out there, which is an amazing thing to think of when you think of the pool of people that are available, not just in America, but internationally, that there might not be enough, like, NBA, like, real top elite professional basketball caliber players out there to fill three or four more teams.
Well, what's fascinating, I mean, I can't remember exactly how many they used to have, but the draft used to be longer.
Yeah.
It's only two rounds now, yeah. So they only are bringing in 60 new players into the league via the draft now.
Yeah.
And a lot of those guys are becoming stash picks where they go and they take someone from Europe or from...
Or go to the D-League, right?
Yeah, and so it is becoming an interesting concept. I mean, there is some merit to what he's saying, that there aren't just this bevy of players that are just stashed away somewhere that are amazing. If they were that good, they'd be playing in the league right away.
Do you have any thoughts about your hometown Chicago Bulls? And, you know, they have had their ups and their downs. Jokum's not back, which makes me very sad. I think he would be an incredible Knick. I think he'd just be like, he would be the toast of this
town. Interesting. I mean, they have Lopez, but he would make some sense. He's a mobile.
I'm just saying, in the abstract, the idea of Jokum in the garden, I think there would be a love affair. But
there would.
The Bulls, you know, Jimmy coming back.
They've been a sad team to watch this year. I mean, so first of all, you've got to be really, really confident in your decision making, or just really egotistical to let Tom Thibodeau go. It reminds me so much. I know you had your day where you went to Ann Arbor and dressed up as Jim Harbaugh.
Right, it's like the Niners and Harbaugh.
It reminds me so much of Harbaugh, and I tweeted that at the time.
Yeah.
Thibodeau, the Bulls had the fourth best record in the league during his four-year run, or however long he was there. And you have to factor in that Derrick Rose missed the majority of those games.
And this was not, if I'm understanding correctly, this was not a case of him like having a riff with the players.
Well, there was some reports toward the end that they had started to tune him out.
Okay.
And I remember being at the last game of his Bulls tenure that they lost to Cleveland in game six. I mean, they did look like they were disjointed or that they weren't really listening. But I don't know that he was the problem. I mean, if players tuned him out, a lot of these players aren't going to be there. You know, obviously, they did re-sign Butler. Rose has one more year left on his deal.
Yeah.
It sounds like they're going to bring back Gasol, which I don't know why they're going to do that at $15 or $20 million a year at 36. But when you look at what Hoiberg is struggling with now, they're falling off the map entirely from a defensive standpoint. Yeah. And
which
so they're losing.
They're losing
their base now. Yeah. They were a defensive team, and now they're trying to figure it out offensively, but they're not good enough to do that. They're 30-30. They could fall below 500 for the first time since probably the Vinny Del Negro era. You probably have to go back that far.
All right, to put you on the spot, who's going to come out of the East then?
Unless LeBron gets hurt, I would still put it on Cleveland. I don't think Toronto. For a seven-game series, I know they just beat Cleveland in a game.
Yeah.
For a seven-game series, I would probably still take Cleveland, though.
Now, this is my, listen, there's a million things that can happen in the West, but we're just going to assume that Golden State figures it out and gets back.
I would assume that, too.
And this is my crazy guy who doesn't watch anywhere near as much basketball as you think theory about a Cavs-Warriors rematch, which is that people have really short-term memories about last year's finals. They do not remember the fact that were it not for a few funny hops, the Cavs very much 3-1. Could have been up 3-love in that series, right?
Yeah, that's a good point.
3-love in that series. They would have been going back to Cleveland up to one game three. That never gets turned around unless it's Red Sox Yankees in 2004. obviously having a championship under the belt and having the experience of that spotlight will be intensely valuable for Golden State. But presuming things stay the course, you're going to get Kyrie in there for a series. You're going to get Love in there for a series. It's a different environment. It's a different thing. And I think people are just waving the flag for the Warriors a little early here.
The only thing, and this is the basketball nerd argument that a lot of us made last year. how heroic it was for LeBron to kind of carry that team on his back.
Yes. But I've never seen anything like it. It was amazing.
I watched Jordan, and I don't think that he did as much as what LeBron was being asked to do.
It looked like LeBron with like four guys he met outside the Quicken Loans Arena 10 minutes before the game.
That's essentially what it was. and that's part of the reason they lost, obviously, a big part of the reason. Right. J.R. Smith, I've always argued, I think is a very useful player, a good player.
Right.
But when he's your fourth scorer as opposed to your second scorer, when you're asking him to step up into that role, when Love and Kyrie aren't there, it's not good.
Yes.
And he just fizzled terribly.
Yes, we call that in the world of parenting, he's a weekend babysitter. You know, it's not like not a Monday to Friday babysitter, okay? You know, like
the biggest problem with that success they had over the first three games, even though they did lose one of them, was that I think part of why they matched up well over that span was that Kyrie and Love can really hurt you. If they're not really, really, really efficient offensively, they can really hurt you on defense because Kyrie most times is not going to stay with Steph that well. Plugging in Dellavedova into the lineup and plugging in Tristan Thompson into the lineup really helped them a lot.
So this weird sort of, you know, retrofitted defense that the
defense
Cavs
looked
had
better.
Was a weird asset. And then you had LeBron playing other naturally as an offensive force,
right.
And that actually allowed them to
steal
a couple of games.
And you knew that wasn't sustainable because he couldn't play 48. I mean, they tried to play him almost every minute of every game, but every time they'd pull him off the court, Golden State would go on a run.
Yeah.
And then even when he was on the court, there was some crazy stat that someone pulled up. I don't think it was me, but someone else did. How Cleveland shot when the passes were stemming from a LeBron feed versus anyone else. They were shooting like almost 50% off LeBron's passes, but like only 15 or 20% off everyone else's.
And then you had weird things like Dellavedova played out of his mind for a couple of games in the middle there and then really came
just
back.
Just wasn't sustainable
Earth.
For seven games against the team that
I hated all the analytics guys shoving in my face after that because I was so psyched for like the Cleveland, up. I would have been such an epic, epic upset. Okay, so last thing here. We haven't really talked about him at all, but the other thing that's happened on this beat is we have sort of the next great basketball player in NBA history, playing among us with Steph Curry. And, I don't want to give LeBron's, crown away. I mean, he's all time. I love that guy. But it's a pretty cool thing to sort of be witness to that you have a guy who is not just a super special player, but is changing the game in a different way.
There aren't really words to describe the way he's played lately. I mean, you literally have to see it. And it's just, that's part of what made Phil's tweet the other day so strange is that he's going to find a way to compare.
Don't you guys remember Mahmoud Abdel-Rauf? What's the matter with you?
I mean, Steph is just firing away from 35, 40, 45 feet and making it look normal. I know he does it in warm-ups, but again, the way we were talking about free throw shooters and the idea of doing it in practice versus doing it in a game, he's doing it in a game.
If
and he's
I
doing
took
it with
that
the game
shot,
on the line.
It would look like someone throwing an air conditioner like out a window. Like I mean, it is an incredibly far shot.
Yeah, and not only is he making it, but he's making I mean, the craziest thing about the replay of that is watching the Oklahoma City players on that bench when he made that game-winning shot, one of them throwing his hands up in disgust before the shot went in. The shot was halfway to the basket, and he already knew they'd lost.
The crazy thing about it, though, I think about my beloved late father who was always like the one howling about bad shot selection. It doesn't feel reckless. It doesn't feel like a bad shot. He's hoisting it from 40 feet, and you're like, yeah, good shot, Steph.
Our colleague Ben Cohen wrote a story about, how well he's shooting from these different distances. He's shooting better from 35 feet, basically, than the other best shooters in the league are shooting from just normal three-point range.
And just to for people who have been with us for all this time and still might not be total analytics people, Steph is a very sort of easy, digestible piece of analytics, new analytics, which is that if he goes out there and he shoots 50% from three, 50%, he doesn't have to shoot 75%, but 50% from three, he is a more efficient player than a guy who's shooting 95% layups and scoring every time, right?
Right.
Yeah, because he's putting more points on the board.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a radical change in the way the game is.
I mean, that's the problem with trying to defend him. And what's scary about him now is that he is starting to become so efficient to where his three-pointers are layups.
Yeah.
That's essentially what is happening, and especially if you don't guard him.
Yeah.
And the problem is you can't realistically guard someone 50 feet away from the basket without getting driven past or
him, right, you know, right.
And so it's right. just how do you defend?
There's a reason the NBA doesn't play full court press.
Or you just you kill yourself trying to guard him that way. And that's what Oscar Robertson is suggesting. It's like you can't really do that.
Yes.
But it's just it's incredible to watch. And it makes every game that they play must-see television.
Chris Herring is the basketball writer for the Wall Street Journal, Knicks correspondent. You can find him at Is it C. Herring WSJ?
Herring WSJ.
Herring. Uh-huh. Like the fish. Herring WSJ online. He has like 50 bazillion followers now.
Not as many as you.
And he takes he occasionally takes out his fans for smoothies.
Yeah, I did that once.
And he might do it again. So if you follow Chris, you might get a free smoothie out of the deal. Chris, thanks so much. Appreciate it. You're listening to the Free For All.
That was our conversation with basketball writer of the Wall Street Journal, Chris Herring. Thanks very much, Chris. And join us every week at the Free For All at WSJ.com.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.